Welcome to Iowa Public Radio's Iowa Art Showcase, our monthly performing arts program devoted to Iowa's not-for-profit arts and cultural organizations. I'm Jacqueline Hallblum. In January, three internationally acclaimed pianists, along with two opera performances and one globally recognized baritone, will sweep the state. We'll speak with internationally acclaimed pianist Andreas Klein about his concert with the Minguet String Quartet. We'll learn about the UNI Opera's presentation of Carlisle Floyd's Susanna. We'll discover how the 2016 Midwest International Piano Competition will be launched. We'll hear about a collaboration between the Des Moines Metro Opera and the Des Moines Arts Center featuring a unique setting of Schubert's Winterreise. And we'll catch up with founder and artistic director of the Cedar Rapids Opera Theater, Daniel Kleinknecht, as he provides background into the CRT's upcoming production of Verdi's La Traviata. That's all ahead on Iowa Public Radio's Iowa Arts Showcase. Thanks for joining us.
I want people to be moved. I want people to cry at the end. I want them to be as moved as I am by this story and by this great music and by 100 people on stage and 50 people backstage making the effort to bring to life these 120 minutes of art. I want them to care about this character. I want them to care about Violetta and what happened to her. And you know what's extraordinary also is Germain and what he learns from this by his manipulation of his son's girlfriend, Violetta, and how he grows from this experience.
Daniel Kleinknecht, founder, artistic director, and conductor of the Cedar Rapids Opera Theater. On January 15th and 17th, the CROT will present Verdi's masterwork La Traviata at the Paramount Theater in Cedar Rapids. The performance will feature 16 young artists and 34 community members as the chorus, along with four dancers and a principal cast of 10. Soprano Danielle Talamantes will sing the role of Violetta, and tenor Jason Sladen will appear as Alfredo. Daniel talks about Verdi's amazing music in La Traviata.
You know, actually it starts from the beginning. The drinking song, the Beviamo, is interesting because it's pretty foursquare. It's the tenor with the entire chorus. And what is noteworthy to me is how we see Verdi here in his middle life writing a drinking song. And then if we look at his entirety of his repertoire, we look at his second to the last opera, Otello. There is another drinking song. And to see how Verdi changed over the decades, literally 1850s, the Traviata, to 1880s, I think, the Otello, to see how this composer has matured is really fascinating to me. I mean, here in the Traviata, it's foursquare, it's not rhythmically challenging, and then in the context of Otello, it's chromatic, it's rhythmic, bum, ba-dum, 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 ba-dum. And it's crazier, it's more drunken when he's older, Verdi. So if you compare that drinking song from the 1850s to in the 1880s in the Otello, you hear much more chromatic, much more rhythmic changes in the drinking song. Funky and rhythmic and tritones and descending, how the alcohol is going to adversely affect Otello and Cassio in the Otello. It's crazy and inspired. So we start with that really wonderful drinking song with the tenor and the chorus. And then the soprano, our Violetta, comes in with A Forse Lui. And this is how she is reflective of her meeting Alfredo. And here we hear her vocal acrobatics. You know, the thing about this character, Violetta, is that in a way it's not just one singer. Because in the first act, she is absolutely the party girl. She is the Traviata Verdi, the soprano who is happy-go-lucky, and she's, you know, the center of attention, and her music is that way. It's full of coloratura, it's high, it's fast-paced. So in this particular aria, A Forse Lui, we hear her, the cabaletta of this being really quite dazzling. And then, of course, later on in the opera, we hear the music becoming more sedate, more mature, as she's fallen in love with Alfredo and as she is living with him. And then, of course, as she's dying, her music is much more centered and focused. And I guess if you think about Verdi, you can't help but think of his great choral settings, the choral aspect of his work. In the end of the second act, he inserts these gypsy choruses and a toreador chorus, and you think, well, you know, this really doesn't have too much to do with giving along the storyline. And in a way, I guess that's kind of an influence of French opera, where you have to have some dance, and you have to have a big chorus thing. So I don't want to say they're there without reason, because they do give a little bit of distraction to the drama, a little bit of sparkle to the stage. And I think without noticing it, they do give a little bit of a foreshadowing of something dangerous, because they're both kind of in minor keys and they do foreshadow, I think, what's going to happen.
Daniel elaborates on La Traviata's principal singers.
They're the heartbeat of this operation here, and I'm telling you, I'm so excited about this entire cast. You know, rarely do I ask back singers year after year, but in the case of Danielle Talamantes, who was our Donana last year in the Don Giovanni, I found a singer I just fell in love with. I thought her music making was direct, was from the heart, and she's just a fabulous performer, a fabulous singer. And, you know, after she left us in January, she went to the Met to sing Frasquita in Carmen. And here she is back with us to sing the Violetta. And I know she's going to be a wonderful Violetta. And I don't know that she and Jason Sladen, our Alfredo, I don't know that they've ever worked together, but they're going to make a wonderful pairing as tenor and soprano. You want to know something else about Jason? It's another extraordinary path for him. He leaves us, and he goes to Lyric Opera of Chicago and makes his debut as Tybalt in Romeo. And he's a stunning tenor, beautiful, beautiful coloratura, nice, bright sound, handsome man. He's going to be a great Alfredo.
So tell us a little bit about the dynamics of this plot, and it sort of reflects a bit of Verdi's life.
I've been thinking about this a lot, how, in a way, Verdi honors and protects this character, Violetta. And why does he do that? Well, we know he loved women because he was married twice, and he fell in love with a singing soprano in the 1840s and 50s. Giuseppina Strepponi was her name. And I read she was pregnant one night, singing a role. The next night, she had the baby. She didn't have a husband at the time, and she gave the child up for adoption. But this is the person that Verdi fell in love with. And I know that Verdi probably was thinking about Giuseppina when he wrote the music for Violetta. And for me, even the opening measures of the prelude and the opening measures of the fourth act prelude, they are like a halo. They're strings played high in a little homophonic phrase, and they're like protectors of this wonderful character that Verdi cared for in a way. You know, he celebrated this character who was a prostitute, who lived in between what was right and what was considered not right in Italy. And he loved her, just, I think, like he loved Giuseppina, who fell outside of the boundaries of what was considered to be correct. So I see a parallel anyway. And then, of course, we see, and I'm going to take this back to Othello, another heroine that Verdi wrote so inspiredly for was Desdemona, who also dies at the end. Of course, she dies knife wound from her husband, Othello. And in this case, of course, Violetta dies of consumption. But the halo that I see in Traviata, I see is that halo in the second act of Othello, where the strings are pulsating high in their register, giving the melody of Desdemona, and then sometimes going in and out of the melody with her, but there with her and as a protector, like a halo. So I think I do see connection between Verdi's life and this character, Violetta.
Founder, artistic director, and conductor of the Cedar Rapids Opera Theater, Daniel Kleinknecht. The Cedar Rapids Opera Theater's production of Verdi's La Traviata will be presented on January 15th and 17th at the Paramount Theater. Members of Orchestra Iowa will serve as the opera orchestra. At noon on Tuesday, January 12th, members of the cast will present a La Traviata opera snapshot on Iowa Public Radio Classical. We hope you'll join us for that sneak peek. IPR's Performance Iowa will also be presenting a live broadcast of the Cedar Rapids Opera Theater's production of Verdi's La Traviata. That will be on the afternoon of January 17th at 2. To hear more segments from Daniel's interview, please go to the drop-down classical menu and click on the Iowa Arts Showcase link on our website at iowapublicradio.org. To get more details about the Cedar Rapids Opera Theater's La Traviata production, please go to cr-opera.org. Just ahead, you'll learn about the UNI Opera Theater's production of Carlisle Floyd's Susanna. You'll hear the inside scoop about this year's kickoff of the Midwest International Piano Competition. You'll find out about the creative inspiration behind an innovative approach to an unusual performance of Schubert's Winterreise. And you'll discover details about the Minguet Quartet with guest pianist Andreas Klein and their concert at the Gallagher Blue Dorn. You're listening to Iowa Public Radio's Iowa Arts Showcase.
Travel and play in different venues, obviously you retain a memory of the good places, and obviously I remember this to be a very favorable venue because the acoustic and the atmosphere and the whole surrounding was very nice. So I remember, yeah, this is great to go back to the Gallagher.
Andreas Klein, guest concert pianist. Andreas will be performing at the Gallagher Blue Dorn with the Minguet Quartet on February 5th. Andreas talks about his upcoming program and the Minguet Quartet.
They are based in Cologne, Germany. We already did two U.S. tours. They are a fantastic ensemble that has done many recordings and is very, very active in Europe and received some awards for their recordings. So they are a very established and renowned group to play with. And so in this tour as well, I'm going to play the Bach D minor piano concerto with them. This originated from a project some years ago, which they called the Homage à Glenn Gould, Homage to Glenn Gould. And we picked pieces that Glenn Gould would have been known for and would have probably be still playing if he would be alive. So they play some pieces that Glenn Gould was associated with. And so, of course, to conclude the program, I'm going to play the D minor Bach concerto with them. And that's always fun. It's a great piece, of course. And I went to Germany and rehearsed with them in Cologne before our first concert tour that started about 2 years ago. And since then, we have played in various places in the U.S. and in Canada. As a solo pianist, as I am, I do not have often the opportunity to play with the chamber ensemble of that caliber. as you can imagine, when you go to a place like Juilliard School, you are trained as a soloist. And the idea still of many young pianists is, well, you study your solo pieces and you study the concerto repertoire, and you're going to be successful as a soloist, maybe having won a major piano competition. But in reality, it is that a pianist in the 21st century has to be very versatile and should also be interested and involved with chamber music and maybe even in accompanying vocalists. So I came to that at a later time in my life where I had the opportunity to play with some ensembles on a chamber music size collaboration. And one of the things I also did was to premiere in the United States a version of the fourth Beethoven piano concerto, which was written by a student of Beethoven, and it's a version that Beethoven sanctioned, and that, of course, was at a time very woke to do when the composer did not have the opportunities to have his work distributed or disseminated among audiences very quickly. So they were, of course, very happy that if a major orchestra could not play their piece, then at least you could hear this piece in a chamber music version. And with the Bach concerto that I play with the Minguet string quartet, it's maybe a similar situation. I do not play this as a soloist with them, but rather an integrated part of the ensemble. So just physically, I'm playing with the piano behind the string quartet, like I would play a piano quintet by other composers.
Tell us about this D minor keyboard concerto. And some people say that they think it started life as really a violin concerto. Give us a little bit of history on it.
Well, you know, there was a time when Bach was very involved in transcribing violin concerti for the keyboard. The keyboard then was, of course, not the modern Steinway piano, but rather the harpsichord. He eventually also wrote his own concerti, but this particular piece started out as a violin concerto by Vivaldi. And I cannot tell you what exactly the differences are in, you know, measure by measure, but obviously it is definitely inspired by a string instrument. And compared to another piano concerto that audiences might know, the pianist in this case is not the soloist compared to those later concerti, but he is much more as well showing off his abilities on the keyboard, but also he's the basso continuo person. So in other words, when you typically have a Baroque piece, you have harpsichord in it anyway. In this case, the harpsichord part is elaborated and has little solos, but the solos are not comparable to any classical or romantic pieces. So the pianist playing a Bach concerto is not the star of the event where the orchestra accompanies the soloist, but it is an integrated part of the chamber ensemble. And therefore the coordination of rhythms and timings and dynamics and all these things have to be much more carefully prepared, because overall it's much more fragile. Obviously, it's not a Rachmaninoff concerto. And so in this type of music, transparency and delicacy of sound is very, very important. And one should remember that because the music is Baroque music, it was not composed and envisioned to be performed on a modern 9-foot concert grand, but rather a fragile harpsichord, that one retains this type of sonority and tonal colors on playing on a modern instrument. And that, of course, is a Pandora box of topics one could discuss, which we don't really have the time for, whether it's a good idea to play Baroque music on modern instruments or not. But to give you a hint of what I believe is that I think that Bach would have enjoyed hearing his pieces on modern instruments, because maybe those composers in the old times got frustrated with the possibilities, the rather limited possibilities that the instruments of the time offered to the composers.
Well, even though this concerto is written in a minor key, it's so brilliant sounding.
Yes, it's not a sad piece, especially the last movement sounds like a dance, and it's very uplifting. Yeah, it's very sparkling in nature. And the first movement has a little bit of more somber tone to it. I believe it shouldn't be played too fast, and it has to have a certain seriousness to it. And, of course, the slow movement is a wonderful aria for the piano being accompanied and intersected by the string players. So overall, it's a fantastic piece. And regretfully, these type of compositions are not showing up in many programs and seasons of orchestras. It seems like everyone wants to hear anything from Beethoven to modern time repertoire rather than some delicate Bach or Mozart or Haydn concerti, because it seems like the taste for most audiences is, oh, we want to see the pianist going all over the keyboard and threading and playing a lot of firework on the keys, rather than also showcasing that music can be very delicate and very transparent and very beautiful without having the big brush in the hand that you have to have for pieces like Maninoff and Tchaikovsky and Prokofiev and other composers like that.
So what is it like having it pared down with just a quartet and not a chamber orchestra?
Well, you have to be even more sensitive to the sonorities that you develop on the modern instrument. You cannot overpower the string quartet, and they in turn also have to be a little bit more aware of the fact that they play with a modern pianist on a modern piano, and that means they have to sound a little bit more robust than they would sound when you play with an orchestra and every part is multiplied. I mean, after all, when you play this, and I just did this, in fact, in October at the Lexington Bach Festival.
You're also going to be doing the Ballade in F minor. Just tell us briefly about that piece.
This is a wonderful piece that Chopin wrote at the end of his life. A ballade is a tragic story by nature, and Chopin wrote four ballades, of which I would say the fourth one is the most complex piece. It's challenging for the pianist, not so much in just technical matters, but in artistic decisions, because the opening theme reoccurs several times. Each time it's embellished, it's reinforced, and towards the end it comes back. And so in playing this piece, like in storytelling, you have to be aware of the evolution of things. And as the piece progresses, there is more added to it. And that means in reality, it's like you tell the same story one more time, but each time it becomes more dramatic. I personally believe very much that any piece that I play is, for me, it's storytelling. It is not just playing notes and playing this from memory and playing it from a pianistic point of view, but I always have the feeling I have to identify with the character that is the music, and I have to find it in learning a new piece. And sometimes I even change my mind as I play a piece for a long time. Maybe I discover something that it never occurred to me, which, of course, makes playing a piece interesting because there's always a new challenge and there's always variety and details to discover that maybe have been overlooked in the past. And so, yes, telling this ballade, so to speak, is a wonderful challenge, but it's also very rewarding because it's a beautiful contrast to the Bach concerto.
Concert pianist Andreas Klein. To hear more from Andreas Klein's interview, please go to the drop-down classical menu and click on the Iowa Art Showcase link on our website at iowapublicradio.org. The Minguet Quartet with Andreas Klein's concert will be held on February 5th at 7:30 p.m. at UNI's Gallagher Bluedorn. For more information and tickets, please go to gbpac.com. Don't go away. You'll catch details about this summer's Midwest International Piano Competition and the concert that unveils it. You'll hear about a creative production of Schubert's Winterreise, and you'll find out about UNI Opera's presentation of Carlisle Floyd's Susanna. You're listening to Iowa Public Radio's Iowa Art Showcase.
Carlisle Floyd is still living, and actually one of the reasons it's really great for college students is that he did compose it to be premiered at Florida State University, so it was not a professional premiere, but actually by students. And there are some really, really interesting quotes by Carlisle himself talking about his own growing up in South Carolina and growing up around evangelical church and having this story of Susanna sort of being something that he grew up around and was familiar with in his own background. So I think he was sort of fascinated by the story of Susanna and the elders that comes from the Apocrypha, and he was looking for something that would be suitable for students, and it was also something that he felt he had lived. And so this combination of things came together, and I love this opera. I've been waiting for a long time to do it. So I'm really excited we're doing it, and I feel that Carlisle Floyd really created an awesome piece of music that tells a universal story, but like an American story too. So I think it's great, and I really hope that people will come out and see this great American opera.
Yeah, his operas have been performed more than any other living American composer, aside from Menotti, actually. Mm. And he really has given an operatic voice to America. His works are filled with a lot of American music, hymns, spirituals, jazz, and it just permeates his scores. He writes with really great clarity and concision and lush lyricism. There's never sort of a wasted moment, and I think that's kind of what makes his stories very immediate and his operas powerful and accessible to audiences. He also writes his own libretti, which is very rare. And we have found that his lines are set so naturally that we've discovered that's exactly the way we would speak them or sing them, even though it's kind of a hard nut to crack at first, the score, but it's a good challenge for the students.
The University of Northern Iowa's Associate Professor of Opera, Mitra Sadapur, and UNI's Associate Professor of Vocal Coaching and Opera and Piano, Dr. Corey Barrett. UNI Opera is presenting Carlisle Floyd's masterwork, Susanna, on January 22nd and 23rd. Floyd stages the opera in the backwoods of Tennessee, where, fueled by rumor and lust, an innocent young woman is accused by the local townspeople of being the devil. Mitra sets the opera in 1946.
We just worked on the revival scene, and it doesn't feel like an operatic scene. It feels like an actual revival experience. I can't describe it except to say that it feels like you are living it as an audience member and as a cast member. So the word setting is just absolutely captures American Appalachian speech. So it feels real. It feels like the people are speaking and singing to you. The sort of mob mentality of the way that the town just turns against Susanna, it's palpable in the room. It feels like realism. And that is a really, really special experience, I think.
And Floyd has commented on that very aspect of what he hopes audiences will get when they come to see his operas. He says, "I expect the audience to be engrossed in the stage action, to have a total theatrical experience in which one element does not dominate. either the music or the drama or the production itself, the concept of total theater in which all the parts are fused in a very exciting one, and this is all too rarely realized, and I think it's absolutely realized in this opera.
And how concise his score and his libretto is. In opera, a lot of times there are all these plots and these subplots.
So true.
You're trying to keep track of everything. But in this, he really does pare it down to just the essential people.
Absolutely. It's very powerful that way.
I also think, though, that it has an amazing part for the ensemble in it as well. So the lead characters' roles are so rich, but also we have about a 16-member chorus that is absolutely essential to the moving forward of the story. So that's another thing I really like.
And a lush character in the orchestra alone. I mean, we're going to be doing this in the dead of winter, but you can hear and you can taste and you can smell the Appalachian mountains and the forests, and it's just delicious.
In addition to Olin Blitch and Susanna, then you have some other characters like these elders' wives, and then her unconventional brother, and then this other young man who's kind of floating through the plot.
Yes, there's a wealth of different characters, and I think Floyd does a masterful job of giving them all music that seems especially natural for them to sing. There's just no artifice when someone is an intolerant church lady, and we have a few of those. They sing some pretty crazy, angular, challenging music that's devoid of melody or happiness at all. And that's very challenging for the students. But once they crack that nut open, they realize, oh, why would she sing anything else other than this? Of course she's singing the ugly music because she has an ugly soul. And Susanna gets the beautiful music because she has the innocent soul. And she's happy for a little bit of the opera. She's happy.
So there are those eight roles of the elders, the four men and their four wives, and they have some, as Corey was saying, some really angular music and sort of accusatory and very declamatory. It really fits speech patterns. And then there are the, Sam Polk is the brother and Little Bat McLean is the friend. And those are two tenor roles, so it's actually a nice tenor opera. And we have two lovely young men singing those roles. But Sam Polk, the brother, he's described by Carlisle Floyd as a misunderstood poet, but he's a man that really can't deal with human nature, or what he considers human nature to be, and so he escapes into the woods and actually does leave Susanna alone during parts of this opera. So that is an unconventional relationship, although they still deeply love each other, and he is involved with how this opera ends. He does try to do the only thing he thinks he can do at the end.
In the face of a steamroller of a town. Mm-hmm. You can really hear that in the score, too. There's just some moments in the orchestra where it's just this relentless, sort of inexorably moving music that just threatens to squash these poor people, and it's just powerful.
The University of Northern Iowa's Associate Professor of Opera, Mitra Sadapur, and UNI's Associate Professor of Vocal Coaching in Opera and Collaborative Piano, Dr. Corey Barrett. UNI Opera is presenting Carlisle Floyd Susanna at 7:30 p.m. on January 22nd and 23rd at UNI's Gallagher Bluedorn. Susanna is being performed with the Northern Iowa Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Dr. Rebecca Burkhart. It will be sung in English with English supertitles. To hear more from Mitra and Corey's interview about this production and the plot synopsis, please go to the drop-down classical menu and click on the Iowa Art Showcase link on our website at iowapublicradio.org. To find out more about the UNI Opera's production and to get tickets, go to uni.edu/music/Susanna-UNI-Opera. You can also get tickets at gbpac.com. Just ahead, Schubert's Winterreise receives a groundbreaking performance in Des Moines, and the Midwest International Piano Competition prepares for another amazing festival. You're listening to Iowa Public Radio's Iowa Art Showcase.
for this year, we have this phrase that's basically life is too short to hear bad piano music. So we want people to come. We want people to come and listen to great performances. They are actually free, with the exception of the final round. You can come Monday through Friday and hear so much of great music if you're free. You can just stay for one person if you have to run and come back again. Just come and listen. I think you'll be surprised because this is just really great. But what makes it really interesting is that just like our concert where two of us are going to be playing, you will hear different people all the time. You know, it's not like one person playing. So I think that kind of keeps it very interesting. And you make up your own mind who you think is the greatest, who you think is not so good, and so on.
I think just being in the Midwest, we're not known as an art mecca. And I think this competition is a vehicle to bring people to the Midwest. And, you know, it's not only about farms and having such wonderful facilities here. I think it's just a perfect place for that, and just to get us out there in the world and to have great piano music here. It's exciting, and that's what we just want to bring the joy of music to everyone.
The University of Northern Iowa's Associate Professors of Piano and co-founders and co-artistic directors of UNI's Midwest International Piano Competition, Dmitry Vorobyev and Sean Botkin. Both Dmitry and Sean, concert pianists themselves, met and became friends on the contest trail. In fact, it was while Dmitry was competing that he decided he wanted to start a piano competition. This year marks the second Midwest International Piano Competition. Dmitry and Sean are launching their competition with a duo recital later this month.
The concert that we're going to play on January 26th was actually our director's idea. So he thought it would be wonderful to showcase Sean and myself in a concert on the stage of Great Hall, where the Midwest International Piano Competition will be happening June 5 through 11 of 2016. And we each play solo recitals. And this is the concert where it's going to be, I think, for people who don't necessarily go to classical solo piano recital, this may be something that is going to be kind of easy to listen, because we are going to have two pianos on stage and we each will present some solo works alternating with each other. And then we will also play one piece which will be four hands. So where we both will play on one piano, then we'll play one piece, or I think it's going to be Dvorak and Brahms dances for two pianos. So the audience is not going to be basically stuck listening to just one person the whole time. I mean, this is going to be something that I think is going to be wonderful piano music and played by two different people and then by them together as well. So we hope that that just attracts more people and also promotes our competition. And people who haven't been to piano competitions think that, oh, it's just kind of not so interesting. You just go and listen to a bunch of pianists. What's so special about it? Well, you're wrong. Last year, for example, we had so many people who were very surprised about the results of the senior category. A lot of the audience members thought that the person who won the third place should have won the first. And it was interesting because the judges unanimously thought that the person who won the first place should have won the first. And so many times when you hear people talk about piano competitions, you always hear, oh, they're political. Oh, this person paid so much money to this person, and that's why this person won. This person studies with this teacher, and that's why she won or he won. All of these things. Well, I've done competitions and with Sean and also with a bunch of other people. And I have to say, throughout the whole competition live that I had, never once I allowed myself to think that way. I always thought, look, everyone has his or her own opinion. You can have the same person play, and I could say that I think this person plays absolutely brilliantly. This is the greatest pianist since Horowitz or something like this. Well, Sean could absolutely disagree with that and say that this person should go sell pies on the street. Well, it's our disagreement, right? But when the result comes, and of course that person maybe doesn't pass or passes, there will be people who will complain that way. They will say, oh, she didn't pass because of politics. I'm sorry, a lot of times it's really about just opinions. And so we need judges who are really well-educated, well-respected, great musicians themselves, so they can pick who they think are the greatest pianists. We can only pray that they pick the same person. So this is just the suspense. Well, is one of those things that just adds a little bit of the sports, I guess, quality to it.
Yes, you can relate it to sports. In fact, you know, people are competing and someone's going to win, someone's going to lose. But it's not as easy like sports where it's so clear, you know, whoever ran the fastest, you know, is the winner. I think that aspect makes it really interesting because of the difference of opinions. And I mean, I guess there's no right or wrong. It's just really how you feel and how you feel with just the performance itself. Someone is moved and someone is not. And I think it's exciting in that aspect and makes it exciting for the audience too. And even if the audience doesn't agree, they're going to be talking about the competition. And I know for our last competition, when we brought back our first prize winner to perform with the Waterloo Symphony, so many people who disagreed with the decision, they said, wow, after hearing her play with the orchestra, now I understand. You know, a lot of them changed their minds and they were really surprised by that. And I think it made them excited for the next year. And so we're really looking forward to 2016 competition.
Judges include Eric Larson, chair of the piano area of the University of North Carolina School of the Arts, and also the Meadowmount School of Music director. Craig Shepard, professor of piano from the University of Washington, Seattle, and Naletta True, professor of piano at Eastman School of Music. Dimitri and Sean fill us in on how we can get more information and tickets for their duo recital and the June finals of the Midwest International Piano Competition.
Well, our recital is on January 26th at 7:30 p.m. in Great Hall of the Gallagher Blue Dorn Performing Arts Center. And information about that could be found on the School of Music website and MidwestPianoCompetition.com. is the website of our competition where they can find all the information about what's happening. We will not have too much information there until about April 1st because the competitors' deadline is March 15th. And only about April 1st, we will know who made the cut, who is coming, so they will have more information about everything.
And competition's happening on June 5 to the 11th of 2016. The final round for the seniors is on the 11th, and there'll be three finalists. Our finalists will perform with the WCF Symphony with Jason Weinberger conducting, and the $25 tickets include catering, so it's a great deal. It's going to be a wonderful final event.
The University of Northern Iowa's Associate Professors of Piano, Dmitry Vorobyev and Sean Botkin, and co-founders and co-artistic directors of UNI's Midwest International Piano Competition. To attend the January 26th UNI Spotlight Series Duo Piano Recital featuring Sean Botkin and Dmitry Vorobyev, please see the UNI School of Music event calendar at uni.edu/music. To hear more about the MIPC and the history behind it from Sean and Dimitri, please go to the drop-down classical menu and click on the Iowa Art Showcase link on our website at iowapublicradio.org. Just ahead, Schubert's Winterreise catches an innovative transformation. This is the Iowa Art Showcase on Iowa Public Radio.
I think it's hard to talk about the music without talking about the visuals. It's hard to talk about the visuals without talking about the music. And it's hard to talk about the voice without talking about the acting, because it really is just one integrated performance. And what we've done in creating this in this way is to create an environment in which it can be presented and developed as such, as one unified performance. And we've made this set white as a metaphor for consciousness, because it is this white little microcosm, this landscape that can take on and reflect all kinds of different images. And it can take on all these different shades of light and tell all these different stories. But at the end of the day, it's still this white blank canvas.
I love visual storytelling, and I think that there are many ways to do it, and that's why I chose to design for dance and theater and opera and film. And I just think it's all one, and I've never really seen sharp boundaries between those mediums, and I've always been trying to fuse those in my work and have one side inform the other, because I think that ultimately what we do is storytelling. That is what we do, either as a performer, as a director, or as a designer. My work in film always informed my work on stage, and my filmic work has always been very theatrical. And it was very exciting for me to start collaborating with David as a visual artist and as a performer, because our set of skills very much complements each other, because I have a lot of knowledge and experience in set and costume design. David has a lot of knowledge and experience in video design and photography, and obviously in performance and music. And so I'm just very excited that now we can work together and collaborate together and combine it into a holistic experience where, for example, in Winterreise, we created a set which can be projected on. It's completely white, and then David is wearing all white, and so at times he just is completely immersed in the video. And so it's kind of this one visual and emotional experience where you don't see such a sharp contrast between, oh, that's a set piece, and here is the performer who stands in front of that set piece and sings something. You know, it's just one immersive experience. And this is what Glimmer is really going for. We're working on fusing the worlds of music and visual art in a very seamless manner.
Scenic and costume designer Vita Zakun and renowned baritone David Adam Moore. Vita and David are co-founders of Glimmer, a production team that stands for giving light, memory, motion, and relevance. Vita and David forged a unique collaboration between the Des Moines Art Center and the Des Moines Metro Opera. Together, they will present their fully staged multimedia production of Schubert's Winterreise. Schubert composed his masterwork cycle for voice and piano in 1827, in which he set 24 poems by Wilhelm Miller. David and Vita talk about Schubert's Winterreise.
It's this world unto itself. Unlike a lot of Western classical vocal music, it doesn't have many elements in it that are culturally specific or that are even specific to a time period. And so it lends itself very well to recontextualizing it in other time periods. And that's something that I'm always very, very interested in doing with classical music, is presenting it as something that is a living, contemporary, relevant form of storytelling. And so when I originally just wanted to sing the thing, because it's amazing to sing, and it's something you can't sing when you're a kid, you know. So, you know, my voice had finally gotten developed enough to be able to make it through the thing, and I was asked to perform a recital in Houston, and I decided to program Winterreise and have that be my first one. But as I was looking through the text for it, I was, you know, like I always would, I'm always trying to think, how would this, I'm trying to picture myself now in this life as that character. And everything just fit. And there was nothing in there that represented sort of values or social restrictions or something that are particular to the early 19th century when the piece was written. So I was like, well, this is like, you know, it's like a couple living together in Brooklyn or something, and things go sour, and he doesn't want to be rejected, so he sneaks out in the middle of the night, but he doesn't have any money, so he is just wandering out in the street. He can't stay,
but he also doesn't have a plan for leaving, and he also doesn't know where to go next, and he doesn't have many options, and so he's just wandering, and it's cold, and it's in the snow, and that's what the story is about. So there's that. It's a powerful story. It's a story that people can relate to. It is vocally and musically, it covers an incredibly wide spectrum of styles. In terms of the type of singing, you get everything from sort of floaty, high, lilting art song, you know, to sort of leader-style vocalisms, to absolute stentorian, Wagnerian drama. You sing high, you sing low, you sing fast runs, you sing long, long sustained phrases like in something from Verdi. It is such a world. And the pianist is an important character in the storytelling, because the piano is used as a device to create the ambient sounds around him. So sometimes the piano is a babbling brook, which is something that Schubert is very, very well known for, being able to bring these colors out of the piano and make it sound like, sometimes the piano is a crow. Sometimes the piano is dogs barking. And so I love the way he uses the piano as another voice. And there are even a couple of songs where the piano actually takes over the melody. The singer will start the main melody and the main theme, and at some point the singer has nothing else to say and the piano takes it over, and then the singer accompanies the piano. It's a brilliant work. It's a world unto itself. I also wanted to get started on it while I was young enough that I would have enough time to really kind of like mess it up and stumble through it and find where the hard parts are, because this is a cycle that singers live with their entire lives and their entire careers. And I feel like I got started on it just late enough to where my voice was developed enough and my technique and such was developed enough to be able to sing it and do it justice, but also early enough that I would have some time to live with it for a while and to be able to develop within it. And it's true, because now I've performed it 20 times, something like that, and I'm still discovering something every time. There's still times when I'll sing a song and it feels like it's the first time I've sung it, because it's 24 songs strung together in a loose narrative with just enough information to give you a very clear idea of the protagonist's emotional journey, but with just enough information left out that you're free to interpret it in a myriad of ways, but both as a performer and as an audience member, and certainly as a director and designer.
Let's talk about some of the various movements and what you try to bring to them.
This has been a constantly evolving project that we've been working on for a few years now. We're presenting it at Atlanta Opera in September, and then New York in December, and then here in January. But every time we try to bring new ideas to it. And so far we've been designing a new set for every time we do it.
Well, because, you know, every venue is ultimately different, and because we are going for an immersive experience, it's important for us to not just transplant an existing event into a venue, but actually very much pay attention to what is the surrounding and where it's going to be performed. And then we respond to that. You know, so in every venue, we rethink it, we reshape it, and make sure that it works within the parameters of the greater space where the audience is actually going to be.
Well, here in Des Moines, you're going to be performing it at the Des Moines Arts Center. So what are you thinking about doing there?
We're talking about that now. We just had the site visit yesterday, and that was mostly photographing, taking measurements of every little corner and you know, the distance between this and that, because there's a lot of, when you're working with projection, especially in the way we do, because we use the entire set as a projection surface, and we use a technique called 3D projection mapping, which restrains the projected image to the projection surface. So in our case, the set is all white, and it has a floor and walls and various elements on the set itself. And we can separate out each little corner and section of the set.
And project only there.
And we only project on the set. There's not one bit of spill from the projector, as they call it, that goes past the set onto any other surface. And it's definitely not in a sort of typical rectangle shape that we're accustomed to seeing, you know, with movies and stuff. In this particular production, the set itself, the performer, objects on the set, everything can light up and take on video and have a life of its own. So right now we're looking at doing it in one of the gallery spaces, which should make for a very beautiful setting for it.
And possibly exposing the snow that hopefully will be outside, because there is a really wonderful huge window in one of the galleries that has a view on the lawn. And Michael Eagle was saying that when it snows, it's actually beautiful because you can see a lot of snow out of that window. So we are hoping to incorporate that into the production so that actually it's even more immersive. Hopefully Mother Nature will cooperate with us on the performance.
Yeah. And I'm very excited about doing it in a context in which art is viewed and consumed, and also about bringing in audiences from the fine arts world who may not have been exposed so much to classical music.
And it's particularly exciting to us to do it in that venue, I think, specifically because of what Glimmer is about. And it's
absolutely
taking all the supposedly different elements like fine arts and design and music and performance and actually truly combining them into one. And so we couldn't be more thrilled than to do it in that venue and to do it in Des Moines and combine audiences together, you know, bring people who typically would come to the art center, but maybe they've never been to the opera before, or maybe bring opera goers, music lovers, and maybe they've never been to those galleries before, you know, and just combining them into one and showing them that ultimately it's all connected.
Also, in this particular interpretation of Winterreise, we're hoping to reach out to a wider spectrum of audience who haven't been exposed to this incredibly powerful art form.
We're using a lot of cinematic quality to communicate to modern audiences, because modern audiences grew up on TV and they grew up on film, and that is a medium that they very easily relate to, but that is also a medium that can say so much, you know. And so we're using modern familiar tools to breach the gap, if you will, and illustrate emotions and connect the dots for the modern audiences and open the door for them to actually be able to experience the piece on a deeper level, because they will understand it better through the aid of cinema and visual storytelling as well as music storytelling.
Scenic and costume designer Vita Zikun and renowned baritone David Adam Moore. The Des Moines Metro Opera joined forces with the Des Moines Arts Center to bring David and Vita to Iowa to present their unique multimedia presentation of Schubert's Winterreise. The DMMO's second stage's performances will be held at the Des Moines Arts Center on January 29th and 30th at 7:30 p.m. and on January 31st at 5:30 p.m. David Adam Moore will be the featured baritone, with the Des Moines Metro Opera's music director and principal conductor David Neely at the keyboard. Winterreise will be sung in German with English supertitles. For more details or tickets, go to desmoinesmetroopera.org. To hear more from David and Vita's interview, please go to the drop-down classical menu and click on the Iowa Arts Showcase link on our website at iowapublicradio.org. Today's Iowa Arts Showcase broadcast is a production of Iowa Public Radio. Program thanks for this show goes to Daniel Klein Connect, Andreas Klein, Mitra Sadapur, Corey Barrett, Sean Botkin, Dmitry Vorobiev, Vita Zikun, and David Adam Moore. Production thanks goes to Iowa Public Radio's Tony Daner and Phil Maas. Thanks for this show also goes to IPR's Jason Burns and Sean McLean, and music director Al Scherz. Program research was provided by Rachel Berenger. For more information on Iowa Public Radio's programming schedule and Iowa Public Radio's Iowa Arts Showcase, please visit our website at iowapublicradio.org. I'm Jacqueline Hallblum. Happy 2016, and thanks for joining us.